be a part of this discussion, something that's very important to me. And I grew up in my young childhood eating commodity foods. And, you know, I didn't know I was eating commodity foods. It was just food. It was our norm. That was the baseline normal type of food that was available to people. We didn't know any different. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in here who had very similar experiences. And for those who don't know about the Commodity Food Program, it's a program through the USDA, and it's food systems and food sources for impoverished people. And there's a whole separate wing called the FDPIR, Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations. And just about every reservation has the Commodity Food Distribution Center. And when I was growing up, it consisted of things like sugar, white bread, lard, a little bit of vegetable shortening, pure corn syrup, and actually on the packaging it said use this on your pancakes. And the lard came in these big blue tins, and I remember we used to use it after we finished all the lard. They were great to carry things around in, you know, so everyone had their blue tins that were the empty lard containers. And looking back on that and thinking about the types of foods that we ate that were just the norm because that's what we had available to us, no wonder we have such high rates of diabetes and other health issues. And what I'm going to talk about today is looking at our indigenous food systems, kind of from a public health perspective, but also from a personal perspective as well. And no disclosures, I'm not being paid by the USDA or anyone else to be here. But what I'll talk about very briefly, just looking at dietary history and evolution of health for indigenous populations. One of my previous roles, I taught American Indian health policy at the law school at Arizona State University for about 4 years. And I had done a lot of background research into the health systems and healing systems and food systems of indigenous peoples around the nation. We'll look at disease patterns and relation to diet, and certainly our modern health concerns and how that relates very closely to diet. So when we're looking at the Aboriginal people of North America, we're talking about the people who are descendants of people who occupied North America prior to contact with Europeans in 1492. But of course, over that time, we had Columbus and many other European explorers who brought things with them, not just disease and warfare, but also even other types of food and ways of thinking about food. So cattle was brought over from Spain, for example. Thousands of distinct tribal groups exist in North America, and of that, there's currently 560 federally recognized tribes. And federally recognized tribes means that the federal government recognizes that entity as a tribal nation. But there are certainly more than 560 tribes in North America. Those are just the federally recognized tribes. And of course, we know that there's been migrations from Asia, if we look at the Bering Land Bridge. And there's very interesting history right there. If we look at food systems and the populations of Western Alaska and Eastern Siberia. And this area, the Beringia, or the Bering Land Strait, has been above water 4 times in the last 60,000 years. And there's evidence that the Eskimo groups, the Yupiks and the Inuits, they live actually on both sides of the ocean there. There's some Eskimos in Alaska, some Eskimos in Siberia. And what we have found is whether you're on either side of the water, if you have a more traditional diet, you're healthier than those who've adopted a more modern diet. So we actually see high rates of obesity and diabetes in those who are now modernized, Eskimos, whether they're on the European side or on the US side, and basically not higher rates of diabetes in those who maintain a more traditional diet. So when we look at the migrations and the populations throughout the Americas, and focusing specifically in North America, we have tremendous differences in the types of food that our populations would eat. So for example, in the Southwest, they did have challenges with drought and trying to grow things in the desert, and those are very amazing pictures to see that you can grow food in those settings. But it's a very different diet than what we'd see, for example, in the Arctic regions, where they couldn't grow any fruits or vegetables. So they were dependent primarily on meat sources, whether it was fish or walrus or seals or other types of meat sources of food. But they lived in a very healthy way. So it's not just one type of food system. So I don't think that just looking at a food pyramid that's generic would apply to every population in this world. Certainly not every population in the United States or every indigenous population. We have to recognize that there are significant cultural differences in the types of food systems that we ate historically and that we eat in current times. Of course, where I'm from, the Great Plains, buffalo was the primary source of most things, including food. And then in the Southwest, where I worked for quite a few years in Phoenix, they were traditional farmers. So if we look at pre-Columbian health status, we know very little. Basically, of what we know is based on skeletal remains. There's not really a written history of health status prior to contact with Europeans. And we know that in areas where they have found civilizations and communities that lived a long time ago, one of the things that we do find is very high rates of infant mortality historically. So you can see under age one is at least 10 to 40% of the skeletal remains are that of infants. So we do know that they had significant health issues historically. And I think it's important to know that even though we have terrible, terrible health disparities in the American Indian population, and we don't live nearly as long as the rest of the nation, we're living longer now than we ever have. And a lot of that is due to things like antibiotics and curing infectious disease. But we still are way behind in terms of modern health status. So if we look at nutrition, growth, and development, there's variation in size, height, primarily due to genetics and the environment, looking at nutrition and physical activity. And we do know that, for example, in the Great Plains, children and adults were similar size to modern Anglo society. Actually, the Lakotas were known as the giants of the plains. We had a high protein diet. We had many people who were well above 6 feet tall 200 years ago, which was not the case even in European cultures. Whereas in the Southwest, where they had less protein sources and more hunter-gathering and predominantly farming, they did tend to be of shorter stature. And we did see a lot of iron deficiency anemia. So that's basically what we know about pre-Columbian health status, not a lot of detail. But looking in the Great Plains, of course, the buffalo was the primary source of protein. And of course, it was not corn-fed, exactly, you know, that it was free range. You know, our people did eat an organic diet historically. So if we think about the way we used to gather food and the meaningful components of just the process of getting food for your community, that was really a strong part of the culture. And if we think about modern times and how separated we are in modern America from the actual processes of getting food, you know, every time you have meat, an animal died. You know, a lot of people have a hard time watching the buffalo get shot. Well, every time you eat meat, an animal died in that process. But we separate ourselves from that a great deal in modern times. We can go to the grocery store and it's wrapped and packaged nice and neatly in plastic wrap, you know, and we can purchase it. We don't even think about the idea that an animal had to die for that. And I think one of the things that we've lost sight of is the spiritual and cultural components of just getting meat for food. And historically, we recognized the profound spiritual implications of that. So it was actually a part of the culture. Then also even in farming communities, I used to work at the Gila River Indian community, home to the Pima Indians, and they're well known in public health for having such high rates of type 2 diabetes. Historically, they were traditional farmers, and they would have ceremonies for planting, ceremonies for harvest, ceremonies for rainfall. And if you've ever heard of the Casa Grande ruins that's located in Coolidge, Arizona, it's an old adobe structure that has windows that align with the summer solstice and the equinoxes. At noon on those days, the sun will shine through those windows. And they did that not because it was a cool thing to do. They did that to mark the changes of season. And that was a strong and meaningful component of the historical culture. Well, if you take away traditional farming, you take that away as well. Also, fishing. You know, it's interesting. If you look at one of the things that was mentioned briefly on the film was omega-3 fatty acids. If you look at the health in Alaska as compared to the Great Plains, and in Alaska there still is a lot of fish in the diet, they've measured that and there are higher levels of omega-3s in Alaska natives. And what's interesting is that they have high rates of diabetes, high rates of obesity, but they do not have high rates of death due to heart disease. Whereas in the Great Plains, we have incredibly high rates of death due to heart disease, and no one's ever studied omega-3 levels in our tribes. Maybe something we need to do. So this is modern day hunting and gathering. Unfortunately. But historically, again, food was a big part of the culture. And here you can see people are gathering for a meal. And there was prayer associated with it. We know who got the food. It wasn't bought at a store randomly. And there's ceremony associated with food, very different than what we do in modern times. So if we think about the history of Indian country, this is Indian country, believe it or not, every last bit of it. We've lost a lot over the years. The 13 colonies, you may have heard of the Trail of Tears and tribes moved westward. Certainly the discovery of gold was not good for the California tribes. And essentially that's what we're left with. We've lost a lot of territory. Can we ever truly get back to our traditional ways of living and our traditional diets the way they used to be? No, we can't. But there are things that we can do to take steps in the right direction. And I think some of the things that we heard about today are steps in the right direction. But I think that with all that loss of territory and the free range that animals used to have and the ability to do traditional farming before there were dams on the rivers, I don't think we'll ever be able to get to that point. But we have seen improvements. Now, the estimated population of American Indians in North America at the time of contact in 1492 was about 2 million. I've heard as low as 2 million, as high as 20 million. In the 2000 census, it was 2.1 self-identified American Indians, but if you include American Indian and other races, it's actually 4 million of us. So it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are in the 2010 census. I think we've really seen a comeback for our population. This is looking at the population of American Indians by county in the United States. This is from the US Census website, and again, this is from 2000 data, so it'll be interesting to see how that has changed over time. So if we look at our health status after contact and in recent years, probably one of the biggest advances, of course, was the discovery of antibiotics, and that's for all populations. We were able to live much longer and not die from infectious disease. However, at that exact same time, rivers in the Southwest were dammed. This is actually the Gila River, and this is where it ends, at the Coolidge Dam. It was completed in 1930. Now, downstream from here, for centuries, the people had traditional farming. They had what they called the Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash. That the corn would have a stalk, the beans would grow up, and the squash would grow well in the summers with the shade from the corn. It was a perfect system. Corn is a vegetable, beans are a legume, squash is a fruit. What a well-balanced diet that they would have at all times. Actually, the original name of Phoenix, believe it or not, was Pumpkinville. The original people who were settling into Phoenix saw all these fields filled with pumpkins and other squash, so they called it Pumpkinville. I think they're glad they changed the name because the Pumpkinville Suns probably wouldn't be as intimidating in the NBA. However, they had the farmed foods, they had fish in the river, and they had a lot of wild game. Things like mule deer and pronghorn sheep lived in the deserts because they had a water supply. As soon as the rivers were dammed, all of those animals had to move upstream. So their diet changed dramatically within a very short period of time. And not surprisingly, they now have the highest rates of type 2 diabetes in the world. Another thing that happened, of course, is the commodity foods program. I described what is included in that. So we kind of had the perfect storm of loss of traditional farming replaced with what I would consider an environmental toxin. We've never looked at the commodity food program as a toxin before, but it's an environmental health issue. We took away good things from the environment, like the river and good food, and replaced it with things that are toxic. And we've never addressed it from that perspective. Talk about a social justice issue and how we dramatically changed the lives of indigenous people and replaced it with things that are just terrible. So we do things like eradicate smallpox, but then we also see increasing rates of type 2 diabetes, and the highest rates of preventable disease in the US is in American Indian populations, especially if we look at type 2 diabetes. At the Gila River community now, half of adults over age 30 have type 2 diabetes. Isn't that remarkable? In the area where I work, we're not very many years behind them. We're increasing our rates of diabetes, and that's true for every population in this country, not just American Indians. I think we're all on that same slope, that same trajectory. We're just all a certain number of years behind where some of our Southwestern tribes are. So looking at death rates due to type 2 diabetes, it's much worse in the Indian Health Service as compared to the rest of the nation, but the Aberdeen area of Indian Health Service, which is the Great Plains region, it's even worse than the rest of IHS. And if we look at socioeconomics, we know that there's a link between poverty, low educational attainment, and poorer health outcomes. And certainly things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, poor blood sugar control in people with diabetes, unfortunately, are more prevalent in people with low income and low educational attainment. And unfortunately, our population has the lowest per capita income and lowest educational attainment in the nation. So we have terrible systems of food that are not healthy for us, and it's embedded within a culture of poverty. And I think a part of the challenge in terms of how do we get more people interested in eating buffalo, I think that's a direct result of the culture of poverty. And when you grow up with poverty, your norms are shifted from what they used to be in our romanticized perspective of the way that we could live and used to live. And if we look at the percent living at or below federal poverty level, IHS, again, nationally much worse than the rest of the nation. Aberdeen area, that's about 170,000 American Indians, 43% living at or below federal poverty. On some of our reservations, it's over 80% of people living at or below federal poverty. Complete dependence on commodity foods, complete dependence on the food, the schools for food. Now, when I was in Arizona, and again, it's a population of children with the highest risk for type 2 diabetes in the world. And because of poverty, the kids were depending on the schools for breakfast and lunch. They did not have healthy food for the kids in the population with the highest risk of type 2 diabetes. I did a site visit. The most popular breakfast item, because the kids are depending on the school for breakfast and lunch, the most popular breakfast item were the giant cinnamon rolls with the caked on white sugar that goes on top of them. And kids would eat two or three at a time because they're hungry. So this is not rocket science. This is basic public health. And we need to make this a priority. We need to invest in better food, healthier food for our children, because talk about a social injustice. The children are innocent. It's not their fault that they're living in poverty. But as a society, as a nation, we haven't found it important enough to invest in their health. This is a little child holding fry bread. Now, when we think about traditional American Indian food, a lot of us, you know, think, oh, fry bread, Indian fry bread. Well, the tribes did not fry bread. The roots of fry bread are in the commodity food program, doing the best you can with your commodities, flour, lard, vegetable shortening. And it's been ingrained in our culture long enough that it's now a part of our culture. And I hope we can change this picture, because historically our people were much healthier. And we can't get back to the exact same systems that we had historically, but we can do a lot better than we're doing right now. And I'll go ahead and end it there. Thank you all very much.
We've got about 20 or 25 minutes, and we really just want to open it up to comments, conversation, dialogue, questions for any and everyone. Yes, please.
Bit of experience with that, and in truth, the commodity food program has improved in recent years. Over the last decade, they have made improvements to have whole grain pasta instead of the other types of pasta that they used to use. They've taken grape juice off of the commodity food program, which is wonderful. A lot of us grew up just these big giant containers of grape juice, which is basically purple water with sugar, is essentially all it was. And so they've taken those things off, but I don't think that we're necessarily using organic foods in the commodity food programs. So we're certainly struggling still with fresh fruits and vegetables, and we're certainly struggling getting buffalo into commodity foods as well.
The reason why I asked is that I know in the Southwest area,
yes, please, go ahead. Could you stand up? We can hear you. Thanks.
So I'm wondering about some concrete sort of next step approaches that are realistic. Are there community gardens One of the things that I think it's important to keep in mind is that Pine Ridge Reservation is 2.2 million acres. We take it, you know, people who study the history of the region, ecologists who have looked at it, John Wesley Powell, many, many commentators have come to the conclusion that this is not farmland. But, what, 37,000 people live on Pine Ridge? 35, 37? Somewhere like that. There are lots of places to grow vegetables on Pine Ridge. And there are lots of vegetable gardens in the summer. Lots and lots. They're all related to older people who developed victory gardens during World War II. So what, there's a disconnect, and I'm just talking about the vegetable question. There's a disconnect between the ability to grow more healthy food and our ability to get it to a distribution point and then distribute it to people. It is possible. Also, on 2 million plus acres of land, there's an ability to have a fairly substantial buffalo herd, or I want to join in on this idea that, you know, if we just moved to grass-fed beef, it would be a healthy, mm-hmm. substantial step forward. It doesn't have to all be buffalo, which bring with them as wildlife fairly complicated management problems, like they get up in the morning in Pine Ridge and go to bed in Kansas. That's a modern management issue. But my point is that we will never get back to the old ways, but there are dozens and dozens of ranchers on Pine Ridge who would like to raise buffalo, who would like to raise grass-fed cattle. They know, but they need a market for it. And we don't have the linkages set up for them to provide, for people who garden to provide vegetables, for people who raise meat to provide meat to the commodity program or into the school systems. Mm-hmm. So in my view, it's not an ecological limitation so much as it is a social. We don't have the social and economic structures.
And a quick response to your question, policy councils certainly aren't out of the question at all. And we have heard reference to the Dine Inc. group over in the Western mm-hmm. Navajo that is actively looking at that and looking at farm to school and one of their programs. With the Navajo, of course, there are a lot of people that I work with that just don't feel confident with their government. Sound familiar? Okay. Getting things done. So a lot of things are being done on the community level. And I think honestly, we need both.
Go ahead, Don.
I was just going to say very briefly that, of course, the biggest challenge we face is poverty. Because if we have people whose basic needs are not getting mm-hmm. met, they're probably not going to be thinking about, you know, counting calories and growing your tomatoes. You know what I mean? They're looking at surviving through the winter. And I think the way I look at it, just Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, mm-hmm. basic needs not being met, we're probably not going to look at other things that maybe are more in the aesthetic realm of, for our people, healthy food, organic, growing, these types of things aren't as high of a priority because basic needs are not being met due to high rates of poverty. And that's the biggest challenge.
You had a question, and then you.
I attended one of the sessions on systems that we use to fight soda pop. And one of the things that I was trying to talk about in that session was about health education for families, impoverished communities. Because we grow up learning how to cook meat from the grocery store, high fat meat because we can only afford the cheapest meat. And then we don't learn about how to prepare foods that are mm-hmm. accessible to us. And we're from Pine Ridge, so I know about Sioux Nation and the inflated prices. And so we were talking about like the food stamp program and the EBT and having some real expensive maybe for families who use their EBT to buy healthier, no sugar, snack food kind of things. And when I mentioned incentive, I think everybody in the room thought that I was talking about financial incentive. But I was actually referring more to, program, education, those kinds of things. That one thing that really struck me is that I'm also a researcher. So we have research that has been done about diabetes and what's causing our diabetes. It's high fat food diets, lack of physical activity. So when we look at the high fat diet, it has a lot to do with how we prepare our food. So educating our impoverished community kind of families all together as a unit, because that's how we do things as a family, might be one of the ways that we can get back to more of our traditional ways of eating, preparing food. And I just wanted to offer that because they were talking about policy and, you know, it's a Republican taking over the shift in power, things like that, how difficult it is going to be for these kinds of programs to get any kind of attention.
Yeah, I know that there are a number of tribes working at the kind of the family level, and there's a program, the Dream of Wild Health in Minnesota, that's actually doing some very interesting work by bringing kids from United Tribes of Little Earth of United Tribes out of Minnesota, out of Minneapolis, and they're taking them up to a farm, and they're actually brought in this past summer for the first time, the mothers of these children, and there was tremendous differences between the beginning of the summer and the end of the summer, both in the way that they were preparing food, but also one woman had lost something like 22 pounds, and yeah, it was dramatic changes. Yeah. Quick comment, and then there's other comments.
The commodity program has been thrown around a lot today. One of the interesting things I discovered in making the movie was that on Pine Ridge, you have to choose between the commodity program or EBT. You can't get both. One's a treaty obligation, one's a income. Commodity is.
It's income.
Okay.
You have to
qualify, but you still can only get one, be involved in one program.
That's interesting. You and then you and then you. Sorry for pointing.
That is a question for Dr. Warren. Given the importance of health, interrelated things are, given the social determinants that you were able to highlight, could you comment on how this had a psychological impact? And how it's also probably resulted in incidents of certain kind of mental illness for the nations that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen with just tremendously high rates of chronic disease is associated high rates of depression. I see that a lot. And I think that that's an arena that we haven't adequately addressed. And as many of you know, one of the other things that we face are high rates of alcoholism, high rates of substance abuse, high rates of suicide on a lot of our reservations. And I think that just growing up immersed in chronic disease has had an impact on that. I think there's actually a culture of diabetes as well. If you live in a community that's been immersed in diabetes, and you've seen grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles, siblings, even children get diabetes, go through amputations, dialysis, heart attacks, strokes, blindness, and death, that changes your perspective of what your future is going to be. And that's not just a public health measure or an academic pursuit in terms of trying to quantify it. That's emotional for people. And I think that's something that we've tremendously underestimated the impact.
You in the back? Yeah.
My name's Larry Klein, and I work with the Sioux Saint-Marie Tribe in Chippewa, and I'm very close with the traditional healers there. We have a good-sized clinic. And diabetes, of course, is number one. I work with the HIV, STD area. So One comment is related to my background and when I kind of left about economic or the development, sustainable. One of the things that we come across over and over and over, and it conflicts with the traditional culture, the society we live in is based on capitalism and it's for profit, and everything you're going to look at and try to develop is going to come up against this basic phenomenon in our culture. Everything, whether you're sick, you have, you know, there's all these needs, there's all this, the health problem, poverty, and if you're not making a profit for somebody, if you're not, if you don't have the resources, in other words, if you don't have the money, you're not going anywhere. Until we change the nature of this, the beast we live under, and incorporate really a combination of, in my opinion, socialism and native culture, we're not going anywhere. Sustainability is whether this country or the world, and it's just my opinion on it. And the traditional healers there are very supportive and work together on all this and try to increase awareness on all this problem. You know, we have a healthcare system that's, when you have making money off of people who are sick, that's basically what it is involved in. You know, what do you get? You know, they love sick people. The pharmaceuticals love HIV. Because look at the billions and billions of dollars they make off of the people I see every day who are fighting to survive. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, please.
Yeah, just want to make a comment about the problem space. Because
what space?
The problem space. The problem space is Homo sapiens writ large. Our evolution, our biologic evolution prepared us.
Can you speak up? It's really hard to hear.
Biologic evolution prepared us for hunting and gathering pre-agriculture. This is about the whole human race. That's the problem space. And if we think you're just on the commodity program, we're all on the commodity program because agriculture production, meat production in this country is subsidized abroad. We are all on the commodity program. We all have an evolutionary biology that prepares us for hunting and gathering, not even agriculture. Not raising grain. So the problem space is spreads across all of us.
God, you guys are really depressing.
Right, please go ahead. Yes, please.
As we, I appreciate the whole idea of transitioning to healthier foods and all of that. But in the meantime, what you brought up, how do we help people cook with what they have? Do you know programs where people are doing that? Because I'm, you know, healthier spam meals. I don't know what we call it, but we're trying to be fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, and actually they have improved the commodity food program. It's much better than it used to be. And there are now cooking classes and cookbooks to try to help families utilize their commodity foods in a better way. So that is something that's available on many reservations now. I don't know what we do with the school-based foods. I know a lot of tribes are looking at that and really want to make improvements. But again, underfunded school systems and living in poverty make it very challenging. And of course, Indian Health Service and our budgets for schools are in that non-defense discretionary category of our budget. So talk about depressing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One other comment on that. At another point in the movie, the lead character's sisters play a big role. And they talk about, at one point, the production team on the movie tries to get them to go through learning how to shop healthy. And the scene in the movie is hilarious. They just say, whoever designed this, it's impossible. to do. You spend hours and hours in the lines and the aisles at Walmart. But they also said, and it was a little bit of a surprise to me, that if there was one outside stimulus into their lives that they would enjoy and benefit from, it would be cooking classes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And that's, yeah. Yeah, there's, please, you, and then we'll have the final word back in the back.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts about sort of connections between tribal poverty and food poverty and how that's changing, if you have any thoughts about that.
I mean, I brought up the idea that certainly sovereignty is in the food system is something that we should all be looking for in our communities and in ourselves. We should have the ability and the right to choose what we eat and how we go about it. But the dimension certainly in tribal communities are undergirded even more by the governmental national sovereignty, of course. But and it's just something that you can rally around, I think, within tribal communities. You can inspire people. The next step is, what do you do about it? And that's perhaps.
Yeah.
Do you have any?
Of course, with tribal sovereignty, we have our own elected officials, and we have a lot of control over our reservations. And I would love to see it become a priority with all the acres we have at Pine Ridge. To imagine the good things we could do to have healthier food. Of course, it takes investment, and we have, again, tremendous poverty limiting our ability to invest in such things. And for me, it's absolutely a priority, but there's a list of a dozen high priorities that are not being adequately addressed because of poverty. And I think that in many ways there are tribal nations, especially in South Dakota, in many ways are like third world nations. Mm-hmm. You know, we just don't have the budget to meet the needs of our citizenry. And I've been saying for the last couple of years, maybe the tribes need to go to China and ask for foreign aid. Because this country certainly isn't living up to its treaty responsibilities to us.
And I think if Mike was here, he would be talking about control of assets.
Like, yes.
And the uranium mining that was mentioned, and the resource extraction, and the power plants just south of us on the Navajo Nation, and the ones that are planned. So that's a critical part of it. So we have that issue. Tribal nations have to have access to that, but they also, within themselves, within the Navajo Nation, there's dysfunction on access to land and water as well. We're having a conference at the end of March in Window Rock about land, not all land and water legal rights, because it's not that we want to get into legal issues, but it is at the core within the tribal sovereignty. There are some dysfunctions there as well. So that's a part of it.
We have time for one more comment, and then I wanted to just tell people that we have put together, Tony has put together a list of resources if you're interested, and it's on the back table. Oh, you passed them out, sorry. We can get you more. And yeah. Yeah, please.
I guess I just wanted to share some positive things that are happening in the last year. And from Indian Health Center, Santa Clara Valley, and in Silicon Valley, there we have 120 different tribes in our urban communities. But we've had amazing success with our diabetes prevention program. We started to build a special diabetes program for youth. And we've been recognized three times nationally. And at this point, we've developed a toolkit to take out, because our events are just so uncertain. And having
Good. Thank you for ending this on a positive note. And I'd like you to join me in thanking the panelists for a really great afternoon.